face, Miriamel suddenly did not ever want to know what Cadrach had done to make him hate himself so much. She shuddered and turned away, looking for her boots. The Sankelenida Nightis seemed strangely deserted, even for the late evening hour. A few priests had gathered in the various common rooms where they sat gossiping in hushed tones. A handful more strode the corridors with lighted candles, on errands of one sort or another. Except for these few, the halls were empty. The torches burned fitfully in their sockets, as though troubled by restless breezes. Miriamel and Cadrach were in a deserted upstairs gallery, passing from the chambers where visiting churchmen stayed, and into the administrative and ceremonial heart of God's house, when the monk pulled Miriamel over to a shadowed window alcove. "Put the candle down and come look," he said quietly. She wedged the taper in a crevice between two tiles and leaned forward. The cold air struck her face like a slap. "What should I look at?"
"There, below. Do you see all those men with torches?"
He tried to point within the confines of the narrow window. Miriamel could see at least a score of men in the courtyard below, armored and cloaked, bearing spears on their shoulders.
"Yes," she said slowly.
The soldiers did not appear to be doing much more than warming their hands at the courtyard fire cairns.
"So?"
"Those are from Duke Benegaris, household guard," Cadrach said grimly. "Someone is expecting trouble tonight. And expecting it to be here."
"But I thought soldiers were never allowed to bear arms in the Sankelenida Nightis."
The spear points caught the torchlights like tongues of flame.
"Ah, but Duke Benegaris himself is a guest here tonight, since he attended the lector's banquet."
"Why didn't he go back to the Sankelen Mahistravis?"
She stepped away from the drafty window.
"It's not very far."
"An excellent question," Cadrach replied, a sour smile playing over his shadow-striped face. "Why, indeed?"
Ducas Grimnor tested Kvarnir's keen edge with his thumb and nodded with satisfaction. He slipped his whetstone and jar of oil back into his bag. There was something very calming about sharpening his sword. A pity he had to leave it behind. He sighed and wrapped it in rags once more, then pushed it underneath his pallet.
"It wouldn't do to go see the lector carrying a sword," he thought. "No matter how much better it'd make me feel, I doubt his guards would take kindly to it."
Not that Escrimnor was going to see the lector directly. It was very unlikely that a strange monk would be allowed into the Shepherd of Mother Church's bedchamber. But Denevan's chambers were close by. The lector's secretary had no guards. Also, Denevan knew Escrimnor and thought highly of him. When the priest realized who his late-night visitor really was, he would listen carefully to what the Duke had to say. Still, Escrimnor felt his stomach fluttering, as it had before countless battles. That had been the reason he'd brought out his sword. Kvarnir hadn't been unsheathed more than twice since it left Naglamund, and certainly hadn't seen any duty that would have dulled her burning forged blade. But honing his sword gave a man something to do when the waiting became difficult. There was something in the air tonight, a queasy expectancy that reminded Escrimnor of the shores of Clodu during the Battle of the Lakelands. Even King John, blooded warhawk that he was, had been nervous that night, knowing that 10,000 Thrithings men waited somewhere in the darkness beyond the sentry fires, and knowing also that the plains dwellers were no adherents of orderly dawn starting times for battles, or any such conventions of civilized warfare. Prester John had come to the fire that night, joining his young Rimmersman friend. Escrimnor had not yet inherited his father's dukedom. For a jug of wine and a bit of conversation. As they talked, the king had taken stone and polishing rag to fabled bright nail. They spent the night yarning away, a little self-consciously at first. with many a pause to listen for unusual noises. Then with increasing ease as dawn approached, and it became obvious the Thriving's men planned no nighttime raids. John told Iskrimnor tales of his youth on Warrensten, which he described as an island of backward and superstition-plagued bumpkins, and of his early travels on the mainland of Osten-Ard. Iskrimnor was fascinated by these unexpected glimpses of the king's early life. Prester John was already nearly 50 years old, as they sat by the fire at Lake Clodagh, and to the young Rimmersman might as well have been king since the beginning of time. But when asked about his legendary destruction of the Red Worm Shurike, John had waved the question away like an irritating fly. He proved no more willing to discuss how he had received Brightnail, saying that those stories were overtold and tiresome. Now, 40 years later, in a monk's cell at the St. Kellenadonitis, Iskrimnor remembered and smiled. John's nervous wetting of Brightnail was the closest the Duke had ever seen his lord come to anything approaching fear. Fear about combat, at least. The Duke snorted. Now, with that good old man 2 years in his grave, here sat his friend Iskrimnor, moping about, when there were tasks to be done for the good of John's kingdom.
Lord Wailing, Dunedain will be my herald. He's a clever man. He'll put Lector and Essen on my side, and will track Miriamel down.
He pulled his hood low on his head, then opened the doorway, letting the torchlight spill in from the corridor. He recrossed the room to put out the candle. It wouldn't do to have it fall over on his pallet and catch the place on fire. Cadrach was becoming increasingly agitated. They had been waiting inside Dunedain's study for some time. High above, the Clavian bell had just sounded the 11th hour.
He is not returning, princess, and I do not know where his private chambers are. We must go.
Miriamel was peering into the lector's great audience hall, through the curtain at the back of the secretary's workroom. Lit by only a single torch, the painted figures on the high ceiling seemed to swim in muddy water.
Knowing Dunedain, his private chambers are probably close to where he works, she said.
The monk's worried tone made her feel a little superior once more.
He'll come back here. He left all his candles burning, didn't he? Why are you so worried?
Cadrach looked up from Dunedain's papers, which he had been surreptitiously examining.
I was at the banquet tonight. I saw Priorati's face. He is a man not accustomed to being balked.
How do you know that? And what were you doing at the banquet?
Doing what was necessary, keeping an eye open.
Miriamel let the drapery slide back into place.
You are full of hidden talents, aren't you? Where did you learn to open a door without a key, like you did to this room?
Cadrach looked stung.
You said you wanted to see him, my lady. You insisted on coming here. I thought it was better we came inside than stand around in the halls waiting for the lector's guards to go by, or one of the other priests who might want to know what we were doing in this part of the St. Kellen.
Lockpick? Spy? Kidnapper? Unusual talents for a monk?
You may make fun if you wish, princess.
He seemed almost ashamed.
I have not had the life of my choice. Or rather, I suppose my choices have not been good ones. But spare me your nasty jibes until we are out of here and safe.
She slid into Dunedain's chair and rubbed her cold hands together, fixing the monk with her best level gaze.
Where do you come from, Cadrach?
He shook his head.
I do not wish to talk of such things. I grow increasingly doubtful that Dunedain will return. We must go.
No. And if you don't stop saying that, I will scream. Then we'll see how that will go down with the lector's guards, won't we?
Cadrach peeked out into the hallway, then quickly closed the door again. For all the chill, his tonsured hair hung on the side of his head in sweaty strands.
My lady, I beg you, I am beseeching you, for your own life and safety. Please let us leave now. It is approaching midnight, and the danger is increasing every moment. Just believe me.
Now he sounded truly desperate.
We cannot wait any longer.
You're wrong.
Miriamel was enjoying the way that things had shifted back in her direction. She put her booted feet up on Denevan's cluttered table.
I can wait all night, if need be.
She tried to fix Cadrach with a stern eye once more, but he was pacing behind her, out of sight.
And we are not going to go fleeing into the night like idiots, without talking to Denevan first. I trust him a great deal more than I trust you.
As you should, I suppose,
Cadrach sighed. He sketched the sign of the tree in the air, then lifted one of Denevan's heavy books and smashed it down on top of her head, tumbling her senseless to the carpeted floor. Cursing himself, he bent to lift her, then stopped as he heard voices in the corridor.
You really must go,
the lector said sleepily. He was propped up in his wide bed, a copy of Ensemblis Edonitis open on his lap.
I shall read for a short while. You really must get some rest yourself, Denevan. It has been a very trying day for all.
His secretary turned from his inspection of the painted panels on the wall.
Very well, but don't read long, sacredness. I won't. My eyes tire very quickly by candlelight.
Denevan stared at the old man for a moment, then impulsively knelt and took the lector's right hand, kissing the Illanite ring he wore.
Bless you, your sacredness.
Renesson looked at him with worried fondness.
You must indeed be overtired, dear friend. Your behavior is quite unusual.
Denevan stood.
You have just excommunicated the High King, sacredness. That makes for a somewhat unusual day, does it not?
The lector waved his hand dismissively.
Not that it will do anything. The king and priorities will do as they please. The people will wait to see what happens. Elias is not the first ruler to suffer Mother Church's censure.
Then why do it? Why pit ourselves against him?
Renesson stared at him shrewdly.
You speak as though this excommunication was not your own fondest hope. You of all people know why, Denevan. We must speak out when evil shows itself, whether there is any hope of changing it or not.
He closed the book before him.
I really am too tired even to read. Tell the truth, Denevan. Is there much hope?
The priest looked at him, surprised.
Why do you ask me, sacredness?
Again you are ingenuous, my son. I know that there are many things with which you do not trouble a weary old man. I also know that there are good reasons for your secrecy. But tell me, from your own knowledge, is there hope?
There is always hope, sacredness. You taught me that.
Ah.
Renesson's smile was oddly satisfied. He settled down into his cushions. Denevan turned to the young acolyte who slept at the foot of the lector's bed.
Make sure you bolt the door behind me when I go.
The youth, who had been dozing, nodded his head.
And do not let anyone into your master's chamber this night.
No, father, I won't.
Good.
Denevan stepped to the heavy door.
Good night, sacredness. God be with you. And you,
Renesson said, muffled in his pillows. As Denevan stepped out into the hallway, the acolyte shuffled over to push the door closed. The hall was even more poorly lit than the lector's bedchamber. Denevan squinted anxiously until he spotted the lector's four guards standing at attention against the shadowed wall. swords scabbarded at their sides, pikes in their mailed fists. He let out his breath in relief, then walked toward them down the long, high-arched corridor. Perhaps he should ask for another two pairs to join these. He wouldn't be sure of the lector's safety until Priorates had gone back to the Hayholt, and treacherous Bene Garis had returned to the ducal palace. He rubbed his eyes as he approached the guards. He did indeed feel very tired, wrung out and hung up to dry. He would just stop and get some things from his workroom, then go to bed. Morning services were only a few hours away.
"Oh, Captain," he said to the one whose helmet bore the white plume, "I think it might be best if you called. Called?"
He broke off, staring. The guard's eyes gleamed like pinpoints in the depth of his helm, but they were fixed on some point beyond Dineven, as were the eyes of his companions. They were all as motionless as statues.
"Captain?"
He touched the man's arm, which was rigid as stone. "In the name of Osiris Aedon," he muttered, "what has happened here?"
"They do not see or hear you."
It was a familiar, rasping voice. Dineven whirled to see a glint of red at the far end of the hallway.
"Deva, what have you done?" "They are sleeping," Priorates laughed. "In the morning they will remember nothing. How the villains got past them to kill the lector will be a mystery. Perhaps it will be viewed by some, the fire dancers, for instance, as a kind of black miracle."
Poisonous fear crawled up from Dineven's stomach, mixing with his anger.
"You will not harm the lector. And who will stop me? You?"
Priorates' laugh turned scornful.
"You can try anything you wish, little man. Scream if you like. No one will hear anything that happens in this hallway until I leave."
"Then I will prevent you myself."
Dineven reached into his robe and pulled forth the tree that hung around his neck.
"Oh, Dineven, you have missed your calling."
The alchemist stepped forward, the torchlight burnishing the arc of his hairless head.
"Instead of lector secretary, you should have sought a position as God's own fool. You cannot stop me. You have no idea of the wisdom I have discovered, the powers I command."
Dineven stood his ground as Priorates advanced, boot heels echoing through the corridor.
"You're selling your immortal soul on the cheapest wisdom. I am happy to have none of it."
His fear mounting, he fought to keep his voice steady. Priorates' reptilian smile widened.
"This is your mistake. You and all those timid fools who call themselves scroll bearers. The League of the Scroll. A gossip society for whimpering, quibbling, would-be scholars. And you, Dineven, are the worst of all. You have sold your own soul for superstitions and reassurances. Instead of opening your eyes to the mysteries of the infinite, you have hidden yourself among the callous-kneed ring-kissers of the Church."
Rage flooded through Dineven's frame, momentarily reversing the tide of terror.
"Stand back!"
he shouted, lifting his tree before him. It seemed to glow, as though the wood itself smoldered.
"You will go no farther, servant of evil masters, unless you kill me first."
Priorates' eyes widened in mock astonishment.
"Ah, so the little priest has teeth. Well then, we shall play the game your way, and I will show you some teeth of my own."
He lifted his hands over his head. The alchemist's scarlet robes billowed as though a wild wind gusted through the hallway. The torches rippled in their sockets, then blew out.
"And remember this,"
Priorates hissed in darkness.
"I command the words of changing now. I am no one's servant."
The tree in Deneven's hand flared more brightly, but Priorates remained sunken in shadow. The alchemist's voice rose, chanting in a language whose very sound made Deneven's ears ache and wrapped a band of agony about his throat. "In the name of God the Highest!" Deneven shouted. But as Priorates' chant mounted toward a triumphant climax, it seemed to tear the words of prayer from his mouth almost before they were spoken. Deneven choked. "In the name of..." His voice fell silent. In the shadows before him, Priorates' voice had become a grunting, gasping parody of speech as the alchemist suffered through some agonizing transformation. Where Priorates had stood, a roiling, unrecognizable shadow now flailed, writhing in knotted loops that grew larger and larger until even the starlight was blotted out, and the hallway sank into unbreachable blackness. Ponderous lungs wheezed like a blacksmith's bellows. A deadening ancient cold filled the corridor with unseen frost. Deneven flung himself forward with a shout of terrified rage, trying to strike the invisible thing with his holy tree, but instead found himself caught up like a doll by some massive yet horribly insubstantial appendage. They struggled, lost in the freezing darkness. Deneven gasped as he felt something pushing its way into his terrified thoughts, scraping inside his head with burning fingers, trying to pry open his very mind like a jam jar. He fought back with all his strength, struggling to hold the image of Holy Aiden in his flickering thoughts. He thought he heard the thing that held him gasp in pain. But the shadow only seemed to grow more substantial. Its grip tightened around him, a horrible bone-cracking fist of jelly and lead. Sour cold breath fluttered against his cheek like the kiss of nightmare. "In the name of God and the League," Deneven groaned. The animal noises and terrible labored breathing began to fade away. Angels of painful, burning light filled his head, dancing to welcome the darkness, deafening him with their silent song. Cadrach dragged Miriamel's limp form out into the hallway, swearing panicky oaths to various saints, gods, and demons. The only light was the thin blue of starlight bleeding in through the windows high overhead. But it was difficult not to see the huddled figure of the priest, laying like a discarded puppet in the center of the corridor a few steps away. It was equally impossible to ignore the ghastly cries and shrieks coming from the lector's chamber at the end of the hall, where the thick wooden door lay splintered across the floor. The noises ceased abruptly, ending on a drawn-out wail of despair that dwindled at last to a gurgling hiss. Cadrach's face filled with horror. He bent and swept up the princess, heaving her over his shoulder, then crouched awkwardly to pick up their bag of possessions. He straightened and staggered away from the destruction at the far end of the hall, fighting to stay on his feet. Around the corner, the passageway widened. But there also the torches had been extinguished. He thought he could see the shadowy forms of armored men standing sentry, but they were motionless as relics. The unhurried echo of booted feet sounded in the arched hall behind him. Cadrach hurried forward, cursing the slippery tiles. The passage turned once more, opening into the great entrance chamber. But as he scurried through the arch, he struck something solid as a wall of adamant, although he had seen nothing in the doorway but air. Stunned, he tripped and tumbled backward. Miriamel slid from his shoulder to the hard floor. The sound of approaching boot heels grew louder. Cadrach reached forward in a fit of panic, encountering an unnatural wall, an invisible but unyielding something. More transparent than crystal, it showed clearly every detail of the torchlit chamber beyond.
"Ah, please, don't let him have her," the monk murmured, clawing with desperate fingers, searching for some flaw in the invisible barrier. "Please." His questing was in vain. The wall was seamless.
Cadrach kneeled before the doorway, head slowly sinking to his chest as the approaching footfalls grew louder. The unmoving monk might have been a prisoner at the executioner's block. Suddenly, he looked up.
"Wait," he hissed. "Think. Idiot man, think!"
He shook his head and took a deep breath, then released it and took one more. He held his palm before the archway and spoke a single, quiet word. A wash of cold air blew past him, ruffling the tapestries in the entrance chamber, The barrier was gone. He dragged Miriamele through, pulling her across the floor and into one of the archways opening off the grand chamber. They disappeared from sight just as Prirati's red-robed figure appeared in the doorway, where the unseen impediment had been. Dim sounds of alarm were beginning to filter through the halls. The Red Priest paused as though surprised to find his barrier gone. Nevertheless, he turned and sketched a gesture in the direction from which he had come, as though to sweep away whatever traces of his handiwork might remain. His voice boomed, reverberating down the corridors in all directions.
"Murder!" he cried. "Murderers are in God's house!"
As the echoes died away, he smiled briefly and set off toward the chambers, where he stayed as the lector's guest. Struck by a thought, Prirati stopped suddenly in the archway and turned to survey the chamber. He lifted his hand once more, fingers flexing. One of the torches gouted sparks, then spat out a tongue of flame, which leaped across to a row of tapestries lining the wall. The ancient weavings blazed, fire licking upward at the great ceiling beams and spreading rapidly from wall to wall. In the hallway beyond, other fires were also blooming. The alchemist grinned.
"One must give omens their due,"
he said to no one present, then departed, chuckling. All around, the babble of confused and frightened voices began to fill the byways of the Sankelen Adonitis. Ducas Grimnor congratulated himself for bringing a candle. The hallway was black as tar. Where were the sentries? Why weren't the torches lit? Whatever the problem was, the Sankelen was awakening all around him. He heard someone shout boldly of murder, which set his heart swiftly beating. This was followed by other, more distant cries. For a few moments he considered returning to his tiny room, but decided that perhaps the confusion was for the best. Whatever the cause of the alarm really was, and he doubted it was murder, it might mean he would be able to find the lector's secretary without having to answer wearisome questions from the lector's guards. The candle in its wooden holder threw his Grimnor's shadow high against the walls of the great entrance hall. As the sounds of approaching discovery grew, he racked his brain for the proper exit from the chamber. He chose the archway that seemed likeliest. A short distance past the second turning of the hallway, he found himself in a wide gallery. A robed figure lay sprawled on the floor amid a tangle of draperies, beneath the unperturbed stare of several armed guards.
"Are they statues then?" he wondered. "But damn me, statuary never looked like that. See, that one there is leaning as though he were whispering to the other."
He stared up at the unseeing eyes that gleamed within the helms and felt his skin crawling.
"Heathen, save us! Black sorcery! That's what it is."
To his despair, he recognized the body on the floor the moment he turned it over. Dinevan's face seemed bluish even by the dim candlelight. Thin stripes of blood had run forward from his ears, drying on his cheek like red tears. His body felt like a sack of broken twigs.
"Elysia, mother of God, what's happened here?" the Duke groaned aloud.
Dinevan's eyes fluttered open, startling his Grimnor so that he almost let the priest's head fall back against the tiles. Dinevan's gaze wandered for a moment before fixing on him. It might have been the candle his Grimnor awkwardly held, but the priest's eyes seemed to burn with a strange spark. Whatever the case, his Grimnor knew it was a spark that would not last long.
"Lector," Dinevan breathed.
His Grimnor leaned closer.
"Look to... Lector!" "Dinevan, it's me," he said. "Duke Iskrimnor. I've come looking for Miriamele." "Lector,"
the priest said stubbornly, his bloodied lips struggling to form the word. Iskrimnor sat up.
"Very well."
He looked helplessly for something to cushion the priest's wounded head, but could find nothing. He led Dinevan down, then rose and walked to the end of the hallway. There was little doubt which room was the lector's. The door lay in great shards, and even the marble around the doorframe was scorched and crumbled. There was even less doubt about Lector Renesin's fate. Iskrimnor took one look around the ruined chamber, then turned and retreated hurriedly into the corridor. Blood had been smeared across the walls, as if by a huge brush. The mangled forms of Mother Church's leader and his young servant were barely recognizable as human. Their corpses had been spared no indignities. Even as Grimnor's old soldier's heart quailed at the sight of so much blood. Flames were flickering in the far archway when the Duke returned, but he steeled himself to ignore them for a moment. Time for thought of escape later. He took Denevan's cold hand.
"The Lector is dead. Can you help me find Princess Miriamel?"
The priest breathed raggedly for a moment. The light in his eyes was fading.
"She's here," he said slowly. "Called Malachias. Ask room, warden."
He gasped for air.
"Take her to Quenitupol, to Pelippus Bowl. Tiamek is there."
Iskrimnor's eyes filled with tears. This man should be dead. There could be nothing keeping him alive but sheer will.
"I'll find her," he said. "I'll keep her safe."
Denevan suddenly seemed to recognize him.
"Tell Joshua," he panted. "I fear false messengers."
"What does that mean?"
Iskrimnor asked, but Denevan was silent, his free hand crawling across his chest like a dying spider, fumbling hopelessly at the neck of his robe. Iskrimnor gently pulled out Denevan's holy tree and laid it on his chest. But the priest shook his head feebly, trying once more to reach inside his robe. Iskrimnor lifted out a golden scroll and quill pendant on a chain. The catch broke as he held it. The chain spilled out into the damp air at Denevan's neck like a tiny, gleaming snake.
"Give Tiamak,"
Denevan rasped. Iskrimnor could barely hear him over the clamor of approaching voices and the crackle of flames in the corridor beyond. The Duke slipped it into the pocket of his monk's robe, then looked up, startled by a sudden movement nearby. One of the immobile guards, illuminated by pulsing fire glow, was swaying in place. A moment later, he fell forward with a crash, his helmet skittering across the tiles. The toppled soldier groaned. When Iskrimnor looked down again, the light had fled Denevan's eyes. Chapter 16. The Unhomed. The darkness in the abbey was complete, the silence marred only by Simon's ragged breath. Then Skodi spoke again, her voice no longer whisperingly sweet.
"Stand up!"
Some force seemed to tug at him, a pressure delicate as a cobweb, but strong as iron. His muscles flexed against his will, but he resisted. A short time before he had struggled to rise, now he strained to lie still.
"Why do you fight me?"
Skodi asked petulantly, her chilly hand brushed across his chest and down onto the quivering skin of his stomach. He flinched, and control of his limbs slipped away as the girl's will closed on him like a fist. A forceful but intangible pull brought him to his feet. He swayed in the darkness, unable to find his balance.
"We will give them the sword," Skodi crooned. "The black sword. Oh, we will get such lovely presents."
"Where are my friends?"
Simon croaked.
"Hush, silly. Go out to the yard."
He stumbled helplessly through the darkened room, barking his shins on hidden obstacles, lurching like a clumsily manipulated puppet.
"Here,"
Skodi said. The abbey's front door swung open on grating hinges, filling the room with baleful reddish light. She stood in the doorway, pale hair fluttering in the swirling wind.
"Come now, Simon. What a night this is. A wild night."
The bonfire in the dooryard blazed even higher than it had when the travelers arrived, a beacon of flame that reached the height of the sloping roof and threw the abbey's cracked walls into red relief. Skodi's children, the young and old alike, were feeding all manner of strange objects into the fire, broken chairs and other bits of ruined furniture, and dead wood from the surrounding forest that burned with a ceaseless hiss of steam. In fact, the bonfire's eager wardens seemed to be throwing everything they could find into the blaze, without regard for suitability. Rocks and animal bones, cracked pottery and shards of coloured glass from the abbey's decaying windows. As the flames roared and leaped in the surging wind, the children's eyes caught the light, glowing like the yellow orbs of foxes. Simon tottered out onto the snowy courtyard, with Skodi following close behind. A keening howl lanced through the night, a wretched, lonely sound. Slow as a sunning tortoise, Simon swiveled his head toward the green-eyed shape, crouched atop the hill that overlooked the clearing. Simon felt an instant of hope as it lifted its muzzle and moaned again.
"Kantaka!" he cried.
The name fell strangely from his stiff jaws and slack lips. The wolf came no closer than the hill crest. She howled once more, a cry of fear and frustration as clear as if it had been spoken with a human tongue.
"Nasty animal!" Skodi said with distaste. "Child eater, moon shelter, it won't come near Skodi's house. It won't break my charm."
She stared hard at the green eyes, and Kantaka's baying became a whimper of pain. A moment later, the wolf turned and vanished from the rise. Simon cursed inwardly and struggled again to break free, but he was still as helpless as a kitten dangled by the scruff. Only his head seemed his own, and every movement was painfully difficult. He turned slowly, looking for Binnabik and Sludig, then stopped, eyes widening. Two crumpled shapes, one small, one large, lay on the frosty ground against the abbey's rotted plaster front. Simon's tears froze into stinging ice on his cheek, as something tugged his head back around and drew him another unwilling step toward the fire.
"Wait," Skodi said.
Her voluminous white nightdress flapped in the wind. Her feet were bare.
"I do not want you too close. You might be burned, and that would spoil you. Stand there."
She pointed a plump arm at a spot a couple of paces away. As if he were an extension of her hand, Simon found himself trudging unsteadily across the thawing mud to the spot she had indicated.
"Vren!"
Skodi cried. She seemed gripped by maniacal good cheer.
"Where is that rope? Where are you?"
The dark-haired boy appeared in the abbey's front doorway.
"Here, Skodi. Tie his pretty wrists."
Vren shot forward, skittering over the icy ground. He grasped Simon's limp hands and pulled them behind his back, then deftly bound him with a length of rope.
"Why are you doing this, Vren?"
Simon gasped.
"We were kind to you."
The Herker boy ignored him, pulling the knots tight. When he had finished, he put his small hands on Simon's hips and pushed him toward where Binnabik and Sludig lay huddled. Like Simon, both had their hands trussed behind their backs. Binnabik's eyes rolled to meet Simon's, the whites gleaming in the fire-shadowed yard. Sludig was breathing, but insensible. A strand of spittle frozen on his blonde beard.
"Simon, friend,"
the troll rasped, each word a labor. The little man drew breath as if to say more, but instead fell back into silence. Across the yard, Skodi had bent to draw a circle in the melting snow, trickling a handful of reddish powder from her fist. When that was finished, she began to scrape runes into the muddy ground, her tongue clenched between her teeth like a studious child. Vren stood a short distance away, swiveling his head from Skodi to Simon and back again, face empty of all emotion but a sort of animal watchfulness. Finished stoking the fire, the children were huddled in the wall of the abbey. One of the youngest girls sat on the ground in her thin shift, sobbing quietly. An older boy patted her head in a perfunctory way that seemed meant to comfort her. They all watched Skodi's movements with fascinated attention. The wind had blown the fire into a rippling pillar, which painted their sober little faces with vermilion light.
"Now, where is Hansa?"
Skodi called, clutching her nightdress closer to her body as she straightened up.
"Hansa?" "I'll get her, Skodi,"
Vren said. He slipped into the shadows at the corner of the abbey, vanishing from sight, then reappeared a few moments later with a black-haired Herka girl a year or two older than himself. A heavy basket swung between them, bumping and jostling across the uneven ground, until they set it down by Skodi's swollen feet and scampered back to the crowd of watching children. Once there, Vren squatted in front of the little group and pulled a knife from his belt and began to nervously shred the end of his remaining hank of rope. Simon could feel the boy's tension from across the yard. He wondered dully what the cause might be. Skodi reached into the basket and lifted out a skull, whose mandible clung by only a few knots of dried flesh, so that the eyeless face seemed to gape in surprise. The bulging basket, Simon now saw, was full of skulls. He suddenly felt sure he knew what had happened to the parents of all these children. His numbed body shivered reflexively, but he perceived the movement only dimly, as though it happened to someone else who was some distance away. Nearby, dark-haired Vren picked at the end of rope with his gleaming blade, his features set in a brooding scowl. Simon remembered with a sinking heart how Skodi had said that beside his other chores, Vren butchered and cooked for her. Skodi held the skull before her, her oddly pretty face utterly absorbed, a scholar studying a table of high mathematical formulae. She swayed from side to side like a boat in a high wind, nightdress flapping, and began to sing in her high-pitched, childish voice.
"In a hole, in a hole," Skodi piped. "In the ground, in a hole, where the wet-nosed mole sings a quiet of cold stone and of mud and grey bone. A quiet, small song all the chill, dark night long, as he digs in the deep, where the white worms creep, and the dead all sleep, with their eyes full of earth, where the beetles give birth, laying little white eggs, and the brittle black legs go scrape, 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 and the dark, like a cape, covers all just the same, darkness hiding their shame as it covered the names of the dead, all gone, all fled, empty winds, empty heads. Above grass grows on stone, fields lie fallow, unsown. All is gone that they've known. So they wail in the deep, crying out in their sleep. Without eyes, still they weep, calling out for what's lost. In the darkness they toss, under pitweed and moss. In the deeps of the grave, neither master or slave has now feature or fame, needs knowledge or name. But they long to come back, and they stare through the cracks at the dim sun above, and they curse cruel love. And the peace lost in life, think of worry and strife, ruined child or wife, all the troubles that burned, dreadful lessons unlearned. Still they long to return, to return, to return. They long to return, return. In a hole in the ground, under old barrow mound, where skin, bone, and blood turn to jelly soft mud, and the rotting world sings.
Skodi's song went on and on, circling downward like a black whirlpool in a weed-strewn and unfrequented pond. Simon felt himself sinking with it, tugging by its insistent rhythms, until the flames and the naked stars and the gleaming eyes of children blurred together into streaks of light, and his heart spiraled down into darkness. His mind could feel no connection with his shackled body or with the actions of those around him. A bleak hiss of idiot noise filled his thoughts. Bleak shapes moved across the snowy courtyard, unimportant as ants. Now one of the shapes took the round, pale object in its hand and tossed it into the fire, throwing a fistful of powder in after it. A plume of scarlet smoke belched forth, trailing off into the sky and obscuring Simon's view. When it cleared, the fire was burning as brightly as before, but a heavier darkness seemed to have settled over the courtyard. The red light that splashed the buildings had become subdued, old as sunset on a dying world. The wind had failed, but a deeper cold crept through the abbey's grounds. Though his body was no longer fully his own, still Simon could feel the intense chill crawling right into his bones.
"Come to me, Lady Silvermask," the largest of the figures cried. "Speak to me, Lord Red Eyes. I want to trade with you. I have a pretty thing you will like."
The wind had not returned, but the bonfire began to waver from side to side, bulging and shuddering like some great animal struggling inside a sack. The cold intensified, the stars dimmed. A shadowy mouth and two empty black eye smudges formed in the flames.
"I have a present for you," the large one shouted gleefully.
Simon, drifting, remembered that her name was Skodi. Several of the children were crying, voices muffled despite the curious stillness. The face in the fire contorted. A low, grumbling roar spilled from the yawning black mouth, slow and deep as the creaking of a mountain's roots. If words were part of that drone, they were indistinguishable. A moment later, the features began to shimmer and fade.
"Stay," Skodi cried. "Why do you go away?"
She looked around wildly, flapping her large arms. Her exhilarated expression was gone.
"The sword," she shrieked at the covey of children. "Stop crying, you stupid oxes. Where is the sword? Vren!"
"Inside, Skodi," the little boy said. He was holding one of the smaller children on his lap.
Despite the curious sense of dislocation, or perhaps because of it, Simon could not help noticing that Vren's arms were bare and thin beneath his ragged coat.
"Then get it, you fool," she cried,
hopping up and down in a leviathan jig of rage. The face in the flames was now barely distinguishable.
"Get it!"
Vren stood up quickly, letting the child in his lap slide to the ground, where it joined its wails to the general cacophony. Vren sped into the house, and Skodi turned to the billowing flames once more.
"Come back! Come back!" she coaxed the diminishing face. "I have a present for my lord and lady."
Skodi's grip on him seemed to diminish somewhat. Simon felt himself slipping back into his body once more, a curious feeling, like donning a cloak of softly tickling feathers. Vren appeared in the doorway, pale face, solemn.
"Too heavy," he called. "Hansa, Ende, your others come here. Come and help."
Several of the children came creeping across the snow toward the abbey at his call, looking over their shoulders at the groaning bonfire and their gesticulating caretaker. They followed Vren into the shadowed interior like a string of nervous goslings. Skodi turned again, her round cheeks flushed, her rosy lips trembling.
"Vren, bring me the sword, you lazy thing, hurry!"
He stuck his head out of the doorway.
"Heavy, Skodi. It's heavy like stone."
Skodi abruptly turned her mad eyes on Simon.
"It's your sword, isn't it?"
The face had vanished from the flames, but the stars, pale as balls of ice, still barely smoldered in the night sky. The bonfire still rippled and danced, untouched by any wind.
"You know how to move it, don't you?"
Her gaze was almost intolerable. Simon said nothing, fighting inwardly with all his might to prevent himself from babbling like a drunkard, from spilling to those compelling eyes every thought he'd ever had.
"I must give it to them," she hissed. "They are searching for it, I know. My dreams told me that they are. The Lord and Lady will make me a power."
She began to laugh, a girlish trill that frightened him as much as anything that had happened since the sun had set.
"Oh, pretty Simon," she giggled. "What a wild night. Go and bring me your black sword."
She turned and shouted at the empty doorway.
Vren! Come! Untie his hands!
Vren popped out into the open, glaring furiously.
No! He screamed. He's bad. He'll get away. He'll hurt you.
Skodi's face froze into an unpleasant mask.
Do what I say, Vren. Untie him.
The boy loped forward, stiff with rage, tears standing in his eyes. He roughly pulled Simon's hands out behind and thrust the knife blade between the cords. Vren's breath came in constricted gasps as he sawed the ropes away. When Simon's hands fell free, the Herka boy turned and sped back to the abbey. Simon stood rubbing his wrists slowly and thought about simply running away. Skodi had turned her back on him and was crooning imploringly to the bonfire. He looked out of the corner of his eye to Binnivik and Sludig. The Rimmersman still lay without movement, but the troll was struggling against his bonds.
Take the sword and run, friend Simon, Binnivik whispered. We will be escaping, somehow.
Skodi's voice cut through the darkness.
The sword!
Simon felt himself turning helplessly from his friend, compelled beyond any possibility of resistance. He marched toward the abbey as though prodded by an invisible hand. Inside, the children were crouched in the darkened hearth corner, still tugging without success at Thorn. Vren glared as Simon entered, but stepped out of his way. Simon kneeled before the sword, a hard, angular bundle wrapped in rags and hides. He unwrapped it with hands that felt curiously blunted. As he grasped the corded hilt, the firelight spilling through the doorway painted a stripe of glowing red along Thorn's black length. The sword shuddered beneath his fingers, in a way he had not felt before, a tremble almost of hunger or anticipation. For the first time, Simon felt Thorn to be something unutterably and loathsomely alien. But he could no more drop it from his hands than he could run away. He lifted it. The blade did not feel painfully heavy as it sometimes did, but it still had a strange weightiness, as though he dragged it up from the muck at the bottom of a pond. He found himself compelled toward the doorway. Somehow, even though she could not see him, Skodi could still move him like a straw doll. He let himself be tugged back out to the red-lit courtyard.
"Come here, Simon," she said as he emerged, spreading her arms like a loving mother. "Come stand in the circle with me." "He has a sword!"
Vren shrieked from the doorway.
"He'll hurt you!"
Skodi laughed dismissively.
"He will not. Skodi is too strong. Besides, he is my new pet. He likes me, don't you?"
She reached out her hand towards Simon. Thorn seemed to be swollen full with some awful, sluggish life.
"Don't break the circle,"
she said lightly, as though they played a game. Skodi clasped his arm and pulled him to her, helping him to lift his clumsy foot over the circle of reddish dust.
"Now they will be able to see the sword."
She glowed with her triumph. One of her warm pink hands clasped his atop Thorn's hilt. The other coiled around his neck, pulling him against her pulpy breasts and stomach. The heat of the fire softened him like wax. The push of Skodi's body against his was like a smothering fever dream. He stood half a head taller, but had no more power to resist her than if he had been an infant. What sort of witch was this girl? Skodi began to shout in piercing Rimmer's back as she swayed against him. The lines of her face began to reform in the bonfire. Through tears that the heat forced from his eyes, Simon saw the unstable black mouth opening and closing like a shark's. A cold and dreadful presence came down upon them, questing, sniffing for them with predatory patience. The voice roared at them. This time, Simon could hear speech in the jumble of sound, unrecognizable words that made his very teeth ache. Skodi gasped in excitement.
"It is one of Lord Red Eye's highest servants, just as I hoped. Look, sir, look, the present you want."
She forced Simon to lift Thorn, then stared eagerly at the shadowy thing. moving in the blaze as it spoke again. Her exhilarated grin soured.
"It does not understand me," she whispered against Simon's neck, with the easy familiarity of a lover. "It cannot find the right road. I feared this. My charm alone is not strong enough. Skodi has to do something she did not want to do."
She turned her head outward.
"Bren, he must have blood. Get the bowl and bring me some of the tall one's blood."
Simon tried to cry out, but could not. The heat within the circle was lifting Skodi's hair like wisps of pale smoke. Her eyes seemed flat and inhuman as potsherds.
"Blood, Fren!"
The boy stood over Sludig, an earthenware bowl in one hand, the blade of the knife, huge in Wren's small fingers, lying against the Rimmersman's neck. Wren turned to look back at Skodi, ignoring Binnebik as the troll struggled on the ground nearby.
"That is right, the big one," Skodi cried. "I want to keep the little one. Hurry, Wren, you stupid squirrel. I need blood for the fire now. The messenger will go away."
Wren lifted his knife.
"And bring it carefully," Skodi cried. "Don't spill any inside the circle. You know how the little ones swarm when charms are spoken. How hungry they are."
The Herker boy suddenly whirled and came stalking towards Skodi and Simon, his face suffused with anger and fear.
"No!"
he screamed. For a moment Simon felt a rush of hope, thinking that the boy meant to strike Skodi down.
"No!"
Wren shrieked again, waving the knife in the air as tears coursed down his cheeks.
"Why are you keeping them? Why are you keeping him?"
He jabbed his blade in Simon's direction.
"He's too old, Skodi. He's bad, not like me." "What are you doing, Wren?"
Skodi narrowed her eyes in alarm as the boy leaped forward toward the circle. The blade swept up, red gleaming. Simon's muscles burned as he strove to throw himself out of the boy's path, but he was clenched in a hand of stone. Sweat sluiced into his eyes.
"You can't like him!"
Wren screeched. With a croaking shriek, Simon managed to squirm just enough for the blade aimed at his ribs to miss and tear along his back instead, leaving a track of cold, silvery pain. Something in the fire bellowed like a bull. Then the darkness fell on top of Simon, blotting out the faded stars. Eolair had left her alone for a moment, while he went back through the great doorway to fetch another lamp. As she waited for the Count of Nad Mullach's return, Maegwin gazed happily down at the vast stone city in the cavern below. A great burden had been lifted from her. Here was the city of the Scythi, of Hernesteir's allies of old. She had found it. For a while Maegwin had begun to believe herself as mad as Eolair and the others thought. But here it stood. It had come to her at first as a certain disorder in her dreams, troubled dreams that were already dark and chaotic, full of the suffering faces of her beloved dead. Then other images began to seep through. These new dreams showed her a beautiful city rippling with banners, a city of flowers and captivating music, hidden from war and bloodshed. But these visions that appeared in the last fleeting moments of sleep, although preferable to her nightmares, had not helped to calm her. Rather, in their richness and exotic wonder, they had inflamed Maegwin with fear for her own troubled mind. Soon, in her wanderings through Griansborg's tunnels, she had also begun to hear whispering in the earth's depths, chanting voices unlike anything she had ever experienced. The idea of the ancient city had grown and flowered, until it became far more important than anything happening within reach of sunlight. Sunlight brought evil. The Daystar was a beacon for disaster, a lamp that the enemies of Hernesteir could use to seek out and destroy her people. Only in the deeps did safety lie, down among the roots of the earth, where the heroes and gods of elder days still lived, where the cruel winter could not go. Now, as she stood above this fantastic stone city, her city, a vast sense of satisfaction spread over her. For the first time since her father, King Luth, had gone away to battle Skali Sharpnose, she felt peace. True, the stone towers and domes spread across the rock canyon below did not much resemble the airy summer city of her dreams. But there seemed small doubt that this was a place crafted by inhuman hands, and it stood in a place where no Hernisteri had walked since time out of mind. If it was not the dwelling place of the deathless Scythi, then what was it? Of course it was their city. That seemed laughingly obvious.
Maeguin, Aelair called, slipping through the half-open door. Where are you?
The worry in his voice brought a tiny smile to her face, but she hid it from him.
I am here, of course, Count, where you bade me stay.
He came and stood at her shoulder, gazing down.
Gods of stock and stone, he said, shaking his head. It is miraculous.
Maeguin's smile came back.
What else would you expect of such a place? Let's go down and find those who live here. Our people are in great need, you know.
Aelair looked at her carefully.
Princess, I doubt very much that anyone is living there. Do you see anything moving? And no lights are burning but our own.
What makes you think that the peaceful ones cannot see in darkness?
She said, laughing at the foolishness of men in general, and clever ones like the Count in particular. Her heart was racing so that the laugh threatened to get away from her. Safety. It was a breathtaking thought. How could anything harm them in the lap of Hernisteir's ancient protectors?
Very well, my lady, Aelair said slowly. We will go down a short way, if these stairs are to be trusted. But your people are worrying about you, he grimaced. And me too, before long. We must return quickly. We can always come back again later with more folk.
Certainly.
She fluttered her hand to show how little such concerns affected her. They would return with all her people, of course. This was the place they would live forever, out of reach of Skali and Elias and the rest of the blood-soaked madmen above ground. Aelair grasped her elbow, guiding her with almost laughable caution. She herself felt the urge to skip down the rough-hewn stairs.
What could hurt them here?
They descended like two small stars falling into a great abyss, the flames of their lamps reflecting from the pale stone roofs below. Their footsteps echoed out through the great cavern and rebounded from the invisible ceiling to be repeated in countless reverberations, returning to them as a rush of pattering sound like the velvet wings of a million bats. For all its completeness, the city nevertheless seemed skeletal. Its interconnected buildings were tiled in a thousand colors of pale stone, ranging from the white of a first snow through endless wan shades of sand and pearl and sooty grey. The round windows stared like unseeing eyes. The polished stone streets gleamed like the tracks of wandering snails. They were halfway down the stairs when Aelair pulled up short, clasping Maeguin's arm close against his side. In the lamplight, his worried face seemed almost translucent. She fancied suddenly that she could see everything that was in his mind.
"We have gone far enough, lady," he said. "Your people will be hunting for us."
"My people?" she asked, pulling away. "Are they not your people, too? Or are you now far above a mere tribe of cringing cave dwellers, Count?"
"That is not what I mean, Maeguin, and you know it," he said harshly.
"That looks like pain in your eyes, Aelair," she thought. "Does it hurt you so to be yoked to a mad woman? How could I have been fool enough to love you, when I could never hope for more than polite forbearance in return?" Aloud, she said, "You are free to go whenever you wish, Count. You doubted me, Now perhaps you are frightened that you might have to face those whose existence you denied. I, however, am not going anywhere but down to the city."
Eole's fine features wrinkled in frustration. As he unknowingly wiped a smear of lamp black onto his chin, Maegwin wondered suddenly what she looked like. The long obsessive hours of searching and digging and chipping away at the bolt that secured the great door floated in her mind like a poorly remembered dream. How long had she been down here in the depths? She stared at her dirt-caked hands with a growing sense of horror. She must indeed look the part of madwoman. Then pushed the thought away in disgust. What did such things matter at an hour like this?
"I cannot let you lose yourself in this place, lady," Eole said at last.
"Then come with me, or bully me all the way back to your wretched camp, noble count."
She suddenly did not like the way she sounded, but it was said, and she would not take it back. Eole did not show the anger she expected. Instead, a weary resignation crept over his features. The pain she had seen before did not go away, but rather seemed to sink deeper, spreading into the very lines of his face.
"You made a promise to me, Maegwin. Before I opened the door, you said you would heed my decision.
I did not believe you an oathbreaker. I know your father never was."
Maegwin pulled back, stung.
"Do not throw my father up to me."
Eole shook his head.
"Still, my lady, you promised me."
Maegwin stared at him. Something in his careful, clever face took hold of her, so that she did not hurry away down the stairs as she had intended. An inner voice mocked her stupidity, but she faced him squarely.
"You are only partly correct, Count Eole," she said slowly. "You could not open it yourself, if you remember. I had to help you."
He looked at her closely.
"So then? So then a compromise. I know you think me headstrong, or worse, but I do still want your friendship, Eole. You have been good to my father's house."
"A bargain, Maegwin?" he asked expressionlessly.
"If you will let us walk down to the bottom of the stairs, just until we can set foot on the tiles of the city, I will turn around and go back with you. If that is what you wish, I promise."
A weary smile touched Eole's lips.
"You promise, do you?"
"I swear by Bagba's head."
She touched her soiled hand to her breast.
"Better you should swear by Black Kuam down here."
He grimaced in frustration. His long tail of hair had shed its ribbon and lay black across his shoulders.
"Very well. I don't like the idea of trying to carry you back up these stairs against your will."
"You couldn't,"
Maegwin said, pleased.
"I am too strong. Come, let's go faster. As you said, people are waiting for us."
They passed down the steps in silence. Maegwin reveling in the safety of shadows and stone mountains, Eole lost in his own unvoiced thoughts. They watched their feet, fearful of a misstep, despite the stairway's great width. The stairs were pitted, crazed with cracks as though the earth had shifted in uneasy sleep. But the stonecraft was beautiful and subtle. The lamplight revealed traces of intricate designs that coiled across the steps and onto the wall above the staircase. Scribings delicate as the fronds of young ferns, or the shingled feathers of hummingbirds. Maegwin could not help turning to Eole with a smile of satisfaction.
"Do you see?"
She held her lamp up to the wall.
"How could this be work of any mere mortals?"
"I see it, lady," Eole responded somberly. "But there is no such wall on the other side of the stairs."
He indicated the drop-off to the canyon below. Despite the distance they had already travelled downward, it was still far enough to kill someone handily.
"Please don't look at the carving so closely that you stumble over the edge."
Maegwin curtsied.
"I will be careful, Count."
Eole frowned, perhaps at her frivolity, but only nodded. The great stairway opened out at the bottom like a fan. spreading onto the canyon floor. Away from the overhanging cavern wall, the glow of their lamps seemed to diminish, the light not strong enough to dispel the deep and overwhelming dark. Buildings which had seemed cunning as carved toys from the height of the canyon rim now loomed above them, a fantastic array of shadowed domes and spiraling towers that tapered up into the blackness like impossible stalagmites. Bridges of living stone stretched from the cavern walls to the towers, winding in and about the spires like ribbons, its various parts tied together with narrow integuments of stone. The city seemed more like a single, breathingly vital thing than an artifact of lifeless rock. But it was surely empty. "The Scythi are long gone, lady, if they ever lived here." Aelair was solemn, but Maegwin thought she heard a certain satisfaction in his tone. "It is time to return." Maegwin gave him a look of disgust. Had the man no curiosity at all? "Then what is that?" she asked, pointing to a faint glow near the center of the shadowed city. "If that is not lamplight, then I am a Rimmer's man." The Count stared. "It does look like it," he said cautiously, "but it might be something else. Light leaking down from above."
"I have been in the tunnels a long while," Maegwin said. "Surely it is well past sunset above ground."
She turned and touched his arm.
"Come, Aelair, please, don't be such an old man. How could you leave this place without knowing?"
The Count of Nad Mullach frowned, but she could see other emotions struggling beneath the surface. He did wish to know, that was plain. It was just this transparency that had captured her heart. How could he be an envoy to all the courts of Ostenard, and yet somehow be as uncloudedly obvious as a child?
"Please," she said.
He checked the oil in the lamps before answering.
"Very well, but only to set your mind at ease. I do not doubt that you have found a place that once belonged to the Scythi, or to men of old who had skills we have lost. But they are long vanished. They cannot save us from our fate."
"Whatever you say, Count. Hurry now."
She tucked him forward into the city. Despite her confident words, the stone byways did indeed seem long deserted. Dust sifted beneath their feet, eddying listlessly. After they had walked a while, Maegwin found her enthusiasm began to diminish, her thoughts turning melancholy as the lamplight threw the jutting towers and swooping spans into grotesque relief. She was again reminded of bones, as though they wandered through the time-scoured ribcage of some impossible beast. Following the twisting streets through the abandoned city, she began to feel herself swallowed up, for the first time the utterness of these depths. The sheer furlongs of stone between herself and the sun seemed oppressive. They passed innumerable empty holes in the carved stone facades, holes whose smooth edges had once been tight-filled by doors. Maegwin imagined eyes staring out at her from the darkened entrances, not malicious eyes, but sad ones. Eyes that gazed at the trespassers with more regret than anger. Surrounded by proud ruins, Luth's daughter felt herself weighted down by all that her people had not become, all that they could never be. Given the entirety of the world's sunlit fields in which to run, the Hernesteri tribes had let themselves be driven into caves in the mountain. Even their gods had deserted them. At least these Scythi had left their memorial in magnificently crafted stone. Maegwin's people built of wood, and even the bones of Hernesteir's warriors, now bleaching on the Inniscrick, would disappear with the passing of years. Soon there would be nothing left of her people at all. Unless someone saved them, but surely none but the Scythi could do that. And where had they gone? Was Aelair right? Were they indeed dead? She had been sure they had gone deep into the earth, but perhaps they had passed on to some other place. She stole a glance at Aelair. The Count was walking silently beside her, staring up at the city's splendid towers, like a farmer from the Kirkoil fringes on his first visit to her Nisanag. Watching his thin-nosed face, his bedraggled tail of black hair, she suddenly felt her love for him come surging up from the place where she had thought it prisoned. a helpless love as painful and undeniable as grief. Maegwin's memory went flying back almost a score of years, to the first day she had seen him. She had been only a girl, but already tall as a grown woman, she recalled with disgust. She had been standing behind her father's chair in the Taig's great hall, when the new Count of Nad Mulloch arrived for his ritual pledge of loyalty. Aelhe had seemed so young that day, slender and bright-eyed as a fox, nervous, but almost giddy with pride. Seemed young? He had been young, scarcely more than 22 years old, full of the suppressed laughter of anxious youth. He had caught Maegwin's eye as she peered, curiously around the high back of Luth's chair. She had blushed scarlet as a berry. Aelhe had smiled then, showing her those bright, small, sharp teeth, and it felt as though he took a gentle bite of her heart. It had meant nothing to him, of course. Maegwin knew that. She was only a girl then, but already fated to become the king's gawky spinster daughter, a woman who lavished her attention on pigs and horses and birds with broken wings, and knocked things off tabletops because she could never remember to walk and sit and carry herself delicately, as a lady should. No, he had meant nothing more than a fretful smile at a wide-eyed young girl. But with that unwitting smile, Aelhe had caught her forever in an unbreakable net. Her thoughts were interrupted as the walled road they had chosen ended before a broad, squat tower, whose surface crawled with ornate stone vines and translucent stone flowers. A wide doorway gaped darkly like a toothless mouth. Aelhe looked at the shadowed entrance suspiciously before stepping forward to peer inside. The interior of the tower seemed oddly spacious, despite the close hovering shadows. A stairway choked with rubble curled away up one inner wall, and a descending stairway passed around the circumference of the tower in the opposite direction. When they drew their lamps back outside the door, a glimmer of light, only the faintest of sheens, seemed to brighten the air where this downward passage disappeared from view. Maegwin took a deep breath. Astonishingly, she felt no fear at being in such a mad place.
"We will turn back whenever you say."
"That staircase is far too treacherous," Aelhe replied. "We should go back now." He hesitated, torn between curiosity and responsibility. There was indeed an unarguable gleam of light from the down track. Maegwin stared at it, but said nothing. The Count sighed. "We will just go a little way on the other path instead." They followed the downward path, spiraling for what seemed a furlong into the depths, until they leveled out at last in a broad, low-ceilinged passageway. The walls and roof were carved with tangled vines and grasses and flowers, a panorama of vegetation that could only grow far above, beneath sun and sky. The interwoven strands of stem and vine ran endlessly along the wall beside them in a tapestry of stone. Despite the immensity of the panels, no part of the wall seemed carved with exactly the same design as any other. The great carvings themselves were composed of many kinds of rock, of an almost infinite variety of hues and textures. But the panels were no mosaic of individual tiles, as was the patterned floor. Rather, the very stone itself seemed to have grown in exact and pleasing shapes, as a hedge coaxed and pruned by gardeners might mimic the form of an animal or bird.
"By the gods of earth and sky," she breathed.
"We must turn back, Maegwin." There was little conviction in Aelhe's voice. Here in the deeps, time seemed to have slowed almost to a stop. They walked on, examining the fantastic carvings in silence. At last, the lamplight was supplemented by a more diffuse glow from the tunnel's far end. Maegwin and the Count stepped out of the passageway and into the open, where the shadowed ceiling of the huge cavern once more arched distantly overhead. They stood on a broad fan of tiles above a great and shallow bowl of stone. The arena, three stone throws across, was lined all about with benches of pale, crumbling chert, as though the deserted bowl had been the site of worship or vast spectacle. A misty white light glowed in the open space of the bowl's center, like an invalid sun.
Kuam and Brynjok,
Eilir swore quietly. There was a distant and anxious edge to his voice.
What is it?
A great angular crystal stood on an altar of dull granite in the middle of the arena, shimmering like a corpse candle. The stone was milky white, smooth-faced but rough-edged as a jagged chunk of quartz. Its strange and subtle light slowly brightened, then died, then brightened again, so that the ancient benches standing nearest seemed almost to flicker in and out of existence with every scintillation. Pale light washed over them as they approached the strange object. The chill air began to seem distinctly warmer. Maegwin felt a moment of breathlessness at the queer splendor of the thing. For long moments she and Eilir stood looking into the snowy glare, watching subtle colors chase each other through the stone's depths, marigold and coral and shy lavender shifting like quicksilver.
It's beautiful, she said at last.
Aye. They lingered, transfixed. At last, with obvious reluctance, the Count of Nad Mullach turned away. But there is nothing else here, lady, nothing. Before Maegwin could speak, the white stone suddenly blazed, radiant, swelling and blossoming like the birth of a heaven star, until the blinding glare seemed to fill the cavern. Maegwin battled to orient herself in the sea of terrifying brilliance. She reached out for the Count of Nad Mullach. Blasted by light, Eilir's face had blurred until his features were almost indistinguishable. His far side had vanished into absolute shadow, so that he seemed but half a man.
What is happening? She cried. Is the stone burning up?
Lady, Eilir snatched at her, trying to pull her back from the glare. Are you hurt?
Ryan's children.
Maegwin reeled back in shock, stumbling unaware into Eilir's protective grasp. The stone had spoken with the voice of a woman, a voice that surrounded them as though mouths spoke from every side.
Why do you not answer me? Three times now have I called to you. I no longer have the strength. I will not be able to try again.
The words were spoken in a tongue Maegwin had never heard, but still their meaning was somehow as clear as if spoken in her own Hernestiri, as powerful as if the woman's voice were inside her head.
Was this the madness she had feared?
But Eilir, too, had clapped his hands over his ears, beset by the same unnatural voice.
Ryan's folk, I beg you, forget our old strife. The wrongs that were done, the greater enemy, now threatens us both.
The voice spoke as though with a great effort. Weariness and sorrow was in it, but something also of immense power. A strength that set Maegwin's skin to tingling. She held her hand splay-fingered before her eyes and squinted into the heart of the glare, but could see nothing. The light that beat out at her seemed almost to push like a strong wind. Could some person be standing in the midst of that staggering incandescence? Or could it somehow be the stone itself that spoke? She found herself sorrowing for whoever or whatever should call out so desperately, even as she fought against the lunatic idea of a shouting stone.
Who are you? Maegwin cried. Why are you in the stone? Get out of my ears! What? Someone is there? At last? Praise to the garden!
Unexpected hope flared in the voice, supplanting weariness for a moment.
Oh, ancient kindred, black evil threatens our adopted land. I crave answers to my questions, questions that might save us all.
Lady, Maegwin at last noticed that Eilir was holding tightly to her waist.
It will not hurt me, she told him.
She moved a little closer to the stone, pulling against his strong arms.
What questions?
She shouted. We are Hernestiri. I am the daughter of King Luth Oblithin.
Who are you? Are you in the stone? Are you here, in the city?
The light from the stone dimmed and began to flicker. There was a pause before the voice came back, more muted than before.
Are you Tinukadeya? I hear you only faintly,
the woman said.
It is too late. You are fading away. If you can still hear me and would give aid against the shared enemy, come to us in Zhao E Tenokai. Some among you must know where it is.
Her voice grew softer still until it was barely a whisper, tickling the insides of Maegwin's ears. The stone had lapsed back into fitful gleaming.
Many are searching for the three great swords. Listen, this might be the salvation of us all, or the destruction.
The stone pulsed.
This is all the year dancing grove could tell me, all the leaves would sing.
Despair welled up in her dying voice.
I have failed. I have grown too weak. First grandmother has failed. I can see only darkness coming.
The soft words at last were gone. The speaking stone dimmed to a smear of pale light before Maegwin's eyes.
I could not help her, Eolair.
She felt quite empty.
We did nothing, and she was so sad.
Eolair gently released her from his grasp. We do not understand enough to help anyone, lady, he said softly. We are in need of help ourselves. Maegwin stepped away from him, fighting back angry tears. Hadn't he felt the woman's goodness, her sorrow? Maegwin felt as though she had watched a wonderful bird thrashing in a trap just beyond her reach. Turning to Eolair, she was startled to see moving sparks in the darkness beyond. She blinked, but it was no phantasm of her dazzled eyes. A procession of dim lights was moving toward them, wending its way down the aisles of the shadowed arena. Eolair followed her stare.
Mora's shield, he swore. I knew I was right to mistrust this place.
He fumbled for his sword hilt.
Behind me, Maegwin. Hide from those who will save us?
She darted around his restraining hand as the bobbing lights approached.
It is the city, at last!
The lights, pink and white, wavered like fireflies as she took a step forward.
Peaceful ones, she cried. Your old allies need you.
The words that whispered out of the shadows came from no mortal throat. Maegwin was filled with wild excitement, certain now that her dreams had spoken truly. The new voice spoke an antique Hernisteri that had not been heard beneath the sunlight for centuries. Oddly, there seemed also a touch of fear in its words.
Our allies are gone to bones and dust now, as with most of our folk. What kind of creatures be you that fear not the shard?
The speaker and his fellow slowly came forward into the light. Maegwin, who had thought herself ready for anything, felt as though the bedrock swayed beneath her. She clutched at Eolair's sword arm as the Count of Nat Mullach hissed in surprise. It was their eyes that seemed so strange at first, great round eyes with no whites. Blinking in the lamp glare, the four newcomers seemed frightened creatures of the forest night. Man tall, but achingly slender. They clutched shining rods of some translucent gemstone in their long, spidery fingers. Fine, pale hair hung down around their bony faces. Their features were delicate, but they wore rough clothes of fur and dusty leather, knobbed at knees and elbows. Eolair's sword rasped out of the scabbard, gleaming pinkly in the light of the crystal rods.
Stand back! What are you?
The being nearest took a step backward, then drew up, its thin face evidencing nervous surprise.
But it is you who be trespassers here. Ah, you do be children of Herne, as we did suspect. Mortals.
He turned and said something to his fellows, in a language like a murmur of song. They nodded gravely. Then all four pairs of saucer eyes turned to Maegwin and Eärlair once more.
No, we have spoken on this, and only meet it is that you make shift to name yourselves.
Marvelling as how the dream had turned, Maegwin steadied herself on Eärlair's arm and spoke.
We are... I am Maegwin, daughter of King Luth. This is Eärlair, Count of Nad Mullach.
The strange creatures' heads bobbled on their slender necks. They spoke melodically among themselves once more. Maegwin and the Count shed a look of stunned disbelief, then turned as the one who had spoken before made a discreet noise in his throat.
You speak with good grace. So, be you gentle folk among your kind, in truth, and promise you mean no harm. Sadly, it has been long since we have had dealings with Hearn's folk, and we are sore ignorant of their doings. We were affrighted when you spoke to the Shard.
Eärlair swallowed.
Who are you, and what is this place?
The leader stared at him for a long moment, the reflection of the lamp flame bright in his great eyes.
Yes, Fitri, am I. My companions hight Shovenne, Himeyan, and Yishadra, who is my wife.
They bowed their heads in turn as he named them.
This city is called Mezutua.
Maegwin was fascinated by Ysfidri and his friends, but a nagging doubt was making itself felt at the back of her mind. They were certainly strange, but they were not what she had expected.
You cannot be the Sithi, she said. What are they? Are you their servants?
The strangers looked at her with alarm on their widespread faces, then took a few pattering steps backward and joined briefly in chiming colloquy. After a moment, Ysfidri turned and spoke a little more harshly than he had before.
We served others once, but that was long ages agone. Have they sent you for us? We will not go back.
For all his defiant tone, there was something tremendously pathetic in Ysfidri's wagging head and huge, mournful eyes.
What did the Shard tell you?
Eärlair shook his head, confused.
Forgive us if we are rude, but we have never seen any like you. We were not sent to look for you. We did not even know you existed.
The Shard? Do you mean the stone? Maegwin asked. It said many things. I will try to remember them. But who are you then, if you are not the Sithi?
Ysfidri did not answer, but slowly lifted his crystal, extending his spindly hand until the rod's rosy light burned heatlessly beside Maegwin's face.
By your aspect, Hearn's people stand not so much changed since we, Tinukedeia of the mountains, last knew them,
he said wistfully.
How is it we are forgotten already? Have so many generations of mortals come and gone? Surely it was only a few turnings of the earth, since your northern tribesmen, the bearded ones, did know us.
His thin face grew distant.
The northerners called us the Fernings, and brought us gifts so we would craft for them.
Eärlair stepped forward.
You are the ones our ancestors called Domaini. But we thought they were legend only, or at least were long dead.
You are the Dwarrows?
Ysfidri showed a mild frown.
Legend? You do be of Hearn's folk, be you not? Who was it, think you, that taught your ancestors to mine these mountains? In days agone, we did, As to names, what matter? Duaro to some mortals, Dvarning or Domaini to others.
He waved his long fingers, slowly, sadly.
Only words. We are Tenukedeya. We come from the garden, and we can never return.
Ayla sheathed his sword with a clang that echoed through the cavern.
You sought for the peaceful ones, princess. This is a strange or stranger. A city in the mountain's heart. The Dwaros out of our oldest legends. Has the world below gone as mad as the world above?
Maequyn was scarcely less astonished than Eolair, but found herself with little to say. As she stared at the Dwaros, she mourned. The black cloud that had lifted for a while seemed to roll back over her mind.
But you are not the Scythi, she said at last, voice flat. They are not here.
They will not help us.
Ysfydra's companions moved up, so that they formed a semicircle around the huddled pair. Watching Maequyn and Eolair worriedly, the wide-eyed Dwaros seemed poised to bolt.
If you came searching for the Zedaya, those who you name Scythi,
Ysfydri said carefully,
then that is of deep interest to us indeed, since we brought us here to hide from them.
He nodded slowly.
Long ago, did we refuse to bend any longer to their will, to their overweening injustice? And so we escaped. We thought they had forgotten us, but they have not. Now that we are weary and few, they seek to capture us once more.
A dim fire was kindled in Ysfydra's eyes.
They even called to us through the shard, the witness which has been silent for many long years. They mock us with their tricks, trying to lure us back.
You are hiding from the Scythi? Ayla asked, confused. But why?
We did serve them once, Harn's child. We fled. Now they would cozen us into coming back. They speak of swords to lure us, for they know that such crafting was always our delight, and the great swords some of our highest works. They ask us of mortals we have never met.